and welcome to Tech Weekly, the technology podcast from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this week we're rousing the rabble.
Daily Mail, 24th of February. A growing number of psychologists and neuroscientists believe they may be doing more harm than good. Dr. Greenfield, a neuroscientist and director of the Royal Institution, believes repeated exposure could effectively rewire the brain.
The scourge in question? Social networking site Facebook. That was Susan Greenfield quoted in the Daily Mail in February, talking about the effect the web has on our brains. The Guardian's new media correspondent Jemima Kish tracked down the Baroness earlier this month and asked a few pressing questions. Keep listening for the full story. Now, Jemima is off scooping another Choice interview this afternoon, so she's not in the pod today, but we are instead joined by our other regulars, who are not so regular, Charles Arthur and Bobby Johnson. Welcome, Charles. What is your favourite mobile app?
I guess it would actually be the Sonos controller, the Sonos, which is a multi-room music player, which works wirelessly, and you can get a downloadable free version for your iPhone, which is just genius, actually.
It is. I have to say that's a phenomenal app, because it means that you don't have to carry around a box. Which is what, £50 itself, the box?
A bit more than £50. Yeah. I think it's £180.
Okay. It's well, yes. Anyway, I stand corrected. I don't know what bus I got, what van I got it off the back of, but it was 50 quid for me. Anyway, Bobby, what precautions are you taking to avoid swine flu over in the US? Because you're kind of close to some of these outbreaks, aren't you?
Oh yeah. I mean, clearly, my life is in danger. I'm taking my life in my own hands by sitting in the ground floor of my flat. In the corner of a room. I don't think I'm going to move from here, actually. I'm just going to stay here and quiver and tremble in fear.
And you are wearing your pajamas, which you can see on the Guardian Tech Weekly Flickr group, which is Guardian Tech Weekly. And Bobby, you're going to stick a picture of yourself up on there, aren't you?
I may need to sanitize it first, but yeah.
Fine. I think for the benefit of everyone, that's a good idea. Anyway, in addition to tackling what Susan Greenfield actually meant when she said that Facebook infantilizes the brain, on today's show, we're looking at what makes an iPhone app a seller, and of course, its developers millionaires, and we're also taking stock of the epidemic of swine flu mashups that have infected the web. All this, plus a breakdown of the annual figures from technology's biggest hitters, from Amazon to Microsoft, plus the latest news, your feedback, and more. Keep listening. We're sure to get your goat. In February this year, Baroness Susan Greenfield made controversial claims about the physiological effects of social media and computer games. According to the Daily Mail, the renowned and respected professor of neuroscience claimed that updating your status on Facebook and fragging your opponents in Counter-Strike literally changed the makeup of your brain. Enter the reactionary crowd. Now, of course, not one to get caught up in the wave of hysteria, our Jemima went out to the root of the rumors. She spoke to Greenfield herself to clarify exactly what she actually thought about interactive media.
Basically, I said three simple facts. The first is that the human brain is very sensitive to the environment. Your brain is changing all the time as you live your life. Two, the environment unquestionably is changing in unprecedented ways as more and more people are living increasingly in terms of the screen and screen technologies, sometimes 6 hours a day or more. And if the brain is sensitive to the environment, and if the brain is changing in an unprecedented, the environment is changing in an unprecedented way, then it follows the brain may be changing in an unprecedented way. Now, where I was just quoted is whether that change is good or bad is, of course, up for debate. And I've never given the value judgment saying that it's necessarily bad for the brain. I think there can be some very positive issues. But what I ask for is really that we debate the issues and decide what kind of brains we want.
Is your research or your concern focused around children, or do you think that a lot of these elements apply to the adult brain as well, or are we kind of beyond help?
The brain is never beyond help, as anyone will know who perhaps has had someone close to them, or perhaps they themselves have had a stroke. The brain is amazing in terms of its potential recovery. It's so-called plasticity. That doesn't mean to say it's made of plastic. It means that it's adaptable and changing all the time. So the very issues that make it sensitive to the environment make it also very vulnerable. But it also that offers the chance for great recoveries. So given that, whilst on the one hand, yes, of course one's concerned for the younger brain, because they don't have the checks and balances, which I'd like to think that we adults have, although that's up for grabs, that it does extend also to the adult brain.
Civilization
stretches back for millennia. And now that we have the opportunity to live in an unprecedented way for healthier, longer lives with more leisure time, is the best we can do, is this the crown of creation, to sit in a room alone playing a computer game?
So it would be fair to characterise some of your concerns as perhaps a lack of social interaction that is encouraged by too much time spent on screen, I suppose. And also you mentioned a kind of ADD syndrome. It's a short attention span. We're encouraged to skim a huge amount of information. And there's a difference between information and knowledge. Right. Is that a fair characterisation?
First, one could say, look, we live in the information age and we need access to information and we need it fast and we need it in huge volumes, all of which may be true. But I think we also need to hook up one fact with another. And just because you can access a fact doesn't mean to say you are automatically going to be able to put it into a context, i.e. into a meaning. And that's why we denigrate Trivial Pursuits or pub quizzes, because, yes, it tests you on your facts and how much you know, but it doesn't test your understanding. It doesn't test how you can put that fact into a context. How can you make that fact work for you to give you some new insight into life? We can't assume that if we're going to live in a society where there's less time spent on that kind of, in inverted commas, 20th century old-fashioned reading and education, we can't assume that people are going to be able to do that in the future.
There isn't an established academic history of research and understanding in this area, and people make a lot of assumptions about new tools like Twitter and Facebook. And something you're calling for is more research and understanding and funding as well, some
and
hard
I think,
cash.
I think we must get rid of the defensiveness that characterises both sides, and that I know that some of the things that I've said to people who are geeks and into techno, the techno world, immediately feel I'm attacking them and saying that they are going to hell in a handcart and so on. Of course, I'm not saying that, because there are many issues where it's been shown that perhaps the screen is good, for example, in promotion of IQ, ability to pass IQ to sensory motor coordination. Fine. But what we need to do is decide what we want our kids to learn. What kind of qualities do we want them to have? I would love to work with Second Life or games or Twitter or whatever, just to work out how we might get to where we want to be rather than just sleepwalking in a haphazard way.
Talking about this in the context of adults rather than children, a lot of our listeners will use many of these screen-based tools for sort of professional skills. And I know that in my work, Twitter and Facebook and a lot of web-based technologies have become really essential for building up a kind of brain's trust. It builds up a network of a very sophisticated communication tool, actually, that, that has definitely supplemented rather than replaced physical face-to-face communication. It doesn't replace it. I mean, is that your understanding, that it is supplementary?
Well, I think one can overgeneralize here. You know, I know that for some people they have very rich and rewarding lives in three dimensions, and of course find computer technology. I'm sure you're one of them, Jemima. Yeah,
find
it. But other people do spend a lot of time alone, either communicating with their 900 friends through a social networking site, and that does beg the question how you see a friend, or perhaps playing games, in which case they are in isolation. And what is inescapable is that there's only 24 hours in the day, and it follows if you're going to spend 6 hours a day or more, i.e. a quarter of the day, doing one thing, you're not spending time doing something else.
Yeah? There are many levels of communication, though, aren't there? I mean, you might physically be sitting on your own if you're playing an online game, but you might also have a headset and be talking to, you know, a couple of dozen other sets of people who are all playing that game. Can we assume that that kind of social interaction and gameplay and team building isn't as valuable as
real world? Well, that's for us to decide. It's a bit like comparing the old-fashioned writing of letters, say, with text messaging. I don't think anyone would say they're the same. Some people might, out of prejudices one way or the other, say one is better than the other. Or is speed dating the same as a long courtship? Of course they're not. And one can't, it's like comparing apples with pears. You can't say one is better than the other, but you can for sure say they're different. And what we need to decide is how we are going to incorporate these different technologies into the portfolio of human interaction, and how we're going to put an emphasis of one over the other.
That was Baroness Susan Greenfield speaking with Jemima. So, Bobby, as a person who's currently sitting in a dark room on your own in your pajamas, isolated, is this the pinnacle of your experience? Do you feel that you're losing out on something, even though we are communicating socially?
You make me want to cry, Alex.
Loser.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I can see where Susan Greenfield's coming from. I actually think what she's a lot of what she's talking about maybe isn't so much about actually the plasticity of the brain, but more about the kind of changing social dynamics that are going on. But I do think that she's kind of fooling herself if she thinks that her message is being seriously distorted by the press. You know, we heard her there say, you know, is playing a game on your own in a room the pinnacle of kind of human evolution? Well, I don't think anyone has ever claimed that it is. And I think this idea that she's not bringing a value judgment by trying to open up this debate is what makes people defensive, because she's clearly come to it with a view and wants other people to do the legwork of proving whether her view is correct or incorrect, which I think is what gets people's backs up.
Now, psychologists and physiologists have been looking at plasticity of the brain for a little while now, and one of the things that they've noticed is that, as Susan Greenfield mentioned, the brain adapts, and you know, if you stick somebody in isolation with a television set, then yes, you are going to see perhaps some effects that have changed over time. But in fact, we're not looking at people in isolation. We're looking at people, if she's talking about young kids, we're looking at people who are socially interacting at school. They're socially interacting after school. And I'm wondering, actually, if either Charles, you or Bobby know of any research that's looked at the effects of television on society, on physiology.
There has, I think, been a study which did find a control, because the problem is always finding a control group. How do you find a group which hasn't been affected by this? And there was a group in something like the Pitcairn Islands or something bizarre like that, where they didn't have TV. Of course, the problem is that if you have a society these days which doesn't have television, then it's going to tend to be a small, closed society. It's not going to have the same sort of electronic technologies. I mean, the problem, I think, with Susan Greenfield's argument is the sort of the subtext to me of what she's saying is, I'm a bit uncomfortable with the way that people are doing these things, because they're not sort of sitting in a room reading a lengthy text. They're not reading War and Peace. Why aren't they doing that? They should be doing that. And there's a sort of element of people should be doing something. And I think the irony actually is that she says, you know, we have more leisure time than ever. And then she's somehow criticizing people for using it, for doing things like playing games and stuff.
And the toothpaste is out of the tube. How do you propose to turn the clock back? You know, if what she's saying is she wants people to sit around reading War and Peace instead of playing games or whatever it may be, how do you change that now that it's different? I think, you know, what when she talks about context, that's really the important thing. I thought it was interesting when she mentioned when she used the phrase, I think, you know, this is why we denigrate people playing Trivial Pursuit or going and doing pub quizzes. I thought that was a really interesting use of words. Susan Greenfield is an incredibly intelligent, well-educated woman who probably, you know, her conversations with her friends are probably, you know, fairly high level. You know, the idea that going to a pub quiz is about displaying your knowledge of contextless facts is a very strange way to look at it. If I go to a pub quiz, it's because I'm having a drink with my friends, and this is an activity that we can, you know, form around. It just strikes me that there's this kind of disconnect there between the context in which you are doing something and what you're hoping to achieve from it.
Well, certainly there is, this was a call for research, as Greenfield herself admits, and you can hear more conversation on this topic on Science Weekly, which was out last week. I listened to it. It's a very good program, I have to say, very good debate. In the meantime, I think, Bobby, the bottom line is that you need to get dressed and get out of your house. Go interact with human beings, not just your cats. And in the meantime, Jemima is actually back, and she'll be giving us the news.
Former UK Home Secretary David Blunkett has spoken out against ID cards in favour of biometric passports. Blunkett said proposals should be dumped and that biometric passports using existing databases would help allay public concerns over plans for a database state. Meanwhile, the UK's Home Office was accused of colluding with Form after a Freedom of Information request revealed the ministry had asked Form for advice in compiling its own guidance for ad targeting services. Form also rolled out a controversial campaign website to target what it called privacy pirates that were trying to bring down its company. Google, Yahoo, Apple, eBay and Amazon all reported first quarter profits last week, but only Apple and Amazon defied the downturn to see revenues go up. Analysts said Amazon had been helped by high street retailers going bust, while Apple saw a continued rise in sales of iPhones and some iPhone applications, which just reached 1 billion downloads globally. Not surprisingly, swine flu has dominated search terms and trending topics on the web all week, but the outbreak also inspired some imaginative data mashups and reinforced the need for public bodies to put out reliable, myth-busting information online through social media.
Thanks, Jemima. So, Charles, talk us through the numbers for the big tech players.
Okay, well, it's a pretty sad story. Not for Apple. Apple up, Amazon up, eBay down, Yahoo down, Microsoft down. First time ever since it's been a public company, Microsoft suffered its first drop in revenue. Revenues were down by 6%, pretty much because business customers weren't spending so much on Windows and Microsoft Office. The servers and tools side held up well, but net profits fell by 32%. Which is, you know, pretty substantial. Apple, by contrast, had its profits up by 15%, and the revenues were $8 billion, up from $7.51 billion. So that's not a very large growth, but still growth. So you know, Amazon and Apple, it's intriguing, I think, that they're both doing well. Where eBay, which has had all sorts of troubles with its the way that it treats its sellers, has not done so well. Yahoo results were slightly down. Yahoo's basically being hit by the fall in internet advertising.
What about Microsoft? How can they regain their better stature?
Well, Microsoft's problems are all tied into the problems that business customers are having. They're all simply putting off any sort of purchases that would involve lashing out money on Windows and Office. As companies hold back on doing that, well, you know, the Windows and Office juggernaut has just been slowing down. So what Microsoft really needs is it really needs to have Windows 7 out there, because corporations just are not upgrading to Windows Vista. They're sticking with Windows XP. The growth in sales of netbooks, which is coming at the expense of PCs, means that Microsoft doesn't get as much money per sale of a netbook as it does for a PC sale. So it really needs to get Windows 7 out there.
And moving from filthy lucre to pestilence, yes, I've been working on that for a while. Bobby, swine flu is clearly a very serious subject, but how serious are the mashups that are happening that Jemima spoke about there in the news?
One of the first ports of call whenever something like this, you know, whenever there's a burgeoning potential pandemic in the offing, is that there's a lot of data out there and people are able to go out, get the data and kind of display it in ways that hopefully give you an idea of what's really going on, not just what people are scared of. So, you know, if you go to the blog, you can see we've put a few links up to different swine flu mashups. But what you can really see is at the moment, there's not a lot actually going on. You know, this is largely an outbreak that's contained in Mexico, and we haven't, at the moment, as time of recording, we haven't seen much in the way of mortality anywhere. So hopefully, you know, this is one point at which, you know, the information we get from the internet and use on the internet allows you to give a kind of a better context, look at information and kind of make your own judgment about whether there's a risk of something happening or not. And I think that's really interesting.
So Wikify the swine flu epidemic is what we're saying. Anyway, you can read up on all these stories and the latest headlines at guardian.co.uk/technology. And you can check out the Guardian selection of the best swine flu mashups from around the web on our page, guardian.co.uk/techweekly. So, you've got a great idea for an iPhone app. It's sure to make you a millionaire. But with more than 30,000 apps available in the iTunes App Store, if not many, many more, how do you make your mark?
With the Last FM app from the App Store, you can listen to great bands. That's the iPhone. Solving life's little problems, one app at a time.
Indeed, this week, Apple announced that they had hit their 1 billion mark. That's 1 billion apps have been downloaded from their service, making it an even more interesting marketplace for an entrepreneur to be. Here to guide us through the process to the dizzy heights of success is David Hamilton, Managing Director of Digital Goldfish, the Dundee-based games developers behind the top 10 bestseller Bloons. That's on the paid-for-content list, no less. Welcome, David, and thank you very much for joining us in the pod. So tell me, David, what is your iPhone app?
You basically play as a mischievous wee monkey, and you throw darts at popping balloons. I know it sounds a bit crazy, but it works.
It certainly does, because you've managed... you released the game earlier this month or in March?
It was 2 weeks ago we launched.
And you've already hit, you've gone from 2 weeks, from zero to hero, basically. You've gone in 2 weeks from releasing the app to hitting the top 10 in the paid for. There was an interesting sort of story to your to you taking this onto the iPhone. Can you tell me a little bit about that? You asked them, there were other mobile developers involved. What was the story there?
Yeah, well, before the iPhone came about, we were obviously in the mobile market. And it was just one of these games that we played at lunchtime. Between everybody in the office. And we used to have great fun competing against each other to see how we get past levels and winding each other up about it. And we then contacted the Ninja Kiwi guys over in New Zealand about with regards to taking it to the mobile. And they basically came back and told us that they had a lot of interest in mobile and they've already got the plan sorted for it. And it wasn't until we got our iPhone developer status that we came up with the idea, because we just constantly kept on playing it with a new level packs that were coming out. It was somebody in the office says, how about we go for the, see what they're doing with Bloons for iPhone. So we contacted them and we managed to get the deal sorted, and here we are now.
Now, would you say though that because it's had such huge success offline, or not offline, but off the iPhone, online, yeah, even as it were, would you say that's a real reason for your success? Obviously, other than the fact that it's, you know, a brilliantly produced game, it looks beautiful, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean that was a starting place for us. Obviously, there's been online games that have been ported over to the iPhone that has not been so successful. As I say, it was just we could have spruced up the graphics trying to make it 3D, but then that's when the original fans might not like that change. So, I mean, what we had to do was obviously keep it true to the original and fun to play. I mean, one of the big problems is the control system. Obviously, we don't have a mouse on the iPhone, so how are we going to control it? But we've played about a few things, and a lot of people are saying it's even better playing on the iPhone than it is online, which is great to hear.
How much experience did you have of coding for the iPhone in order to make this port?
The iPhone, this was actually our first iPhone project. We've been used to mobile. We released two titles prior to this on mobile. We released a game called Baby Grow for the original JTME Java handsets, and a game called Reach for the Stars. And I mean, we found iPhone development, we look at actually iPhone as sort of different to the mobile, just because the changes in the codes and things. I mean, for mobile, you need at least 50 different builds to get it working on a standard number of handsets to be able to get on the operator deck, whereas on the iPhone, it's just one version.
So that makes making a port much simpler?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, on mobile, you need to make a 64 kilobyte build, which works on the sort of Nokia 7250, even though I don't know who still owns that handset, but it's still a criteria that you must make these builds for getting the handset to get an operator deck. They must have that phone on the compatible list. So you can imagine trying to get a game down to 63 kilobytes, 64 kilobytes to work on these handsets.
Now, arguably, one of the other keys to your success, David, was that you had a relationship with Apple. So, you know, you may have jumped straight up to the top 10 list, but in fact, probably one of the reasons is because you managed to get a button on the front of the App Store. How did that happen? How did you go about sort of gaining that?
Yeah, I mean, that was brilliant to be featured on the App Store. We're really lucky to be based in Dundee in Scotland, where there's a cluster of games companies, and I mean, I think it's got the history of the games now with Grand Theft Auto and Lemmings and things like that. It started it off. Now we've got a lot of other developers around us that have worked on big titles. So Dundee's well known for the sort of attracting people to hear about Dundee in terms of development. So we did gain a lot of credibility from that. And it was just a case of contacting Apple, showing them what we had. And luckily enough, they liked it and were good enough to give us such a good feature.
Bobby?
I was looking at some figures that suggest about three quarters of apps are paid for, but that the price is going down over time, the average price. Do you think if you put it out at a cheaper, a lower price, that you'd get even more downloads, or is there a balance to be made there?
I think, I mean, originally when we first put it out, I think we would get a lot more sales, but obviously we need to sell three times as much if we were selling it for 59p. I was trying to think what can we give them that they don't have when they can play online. So we give them like 50 exclusive levels. There's unlockable content if you complete it all. And the great thing about the iPhone is the updates. So I mean, we're looking at along the lines, okay, it's 179, but they're basically buying the console to be able to continue to play Bloons.
It's actually fairly opaque. You know, we can see where people rank in the charts, but there's very little idea of necessarily how many downloads they're getting. And you know, obviously that's a important point for anyone who's looking at developing. You know, how many of these am I going to sell to people? Now I don't know if those numbers are private, but can you give us any insight? What does it take to become a top 10 app?
Obviously, I'm not. I think we're contracted with Apple. Actually, we can't speak about figures. So unfortunately, I won't be able to give you a sort of top of the range. But it's more than we expected.
But I mean, you know, I'm assuming we're talking what, tens of thousands of downloads.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's depending on your pricing point. So I mean, when we go in, I'm sure the top five will be selling a hell of a lot more than we'll be selling down at number 10, but it is more than expected.
We've got a couple of questions from listeners. Tombot18 asks if it's even worth building an iPhone app at the moment. What's your response to that?
In terms of starting a studio and making iPhone games, it will be difficult if it's just Tom himself. The Stick Wars, that's now up there. I mean, that started off as one guy. I mean, that's hugely successful. Number one in America just now, I think number two in the UK. It's just getting the right game idea. So it's worth giving it a go if you've got coding skills behind you.
And Phil Wheat asks, how can you translate your iPhone app idea to reality if you've not got programming experience? Where's the best place to start?
It's C that you've got to learn to program on an iPhone. If he's not got any programming experience, either speak to his friends, see if he's got anybody, or post on forums. And I'm sure there's a lot of keen coders out there that are willing to put their skills in practice. If not, if he starts looking at C coding, he might be able to pick it up himself.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, David. That was David Hamilton from Digital Goldfish, the creators of Bloons. For more on the iPhone and its apps, head over to guardian.co.uk/technology. So what have you been saying on the blogs this week? Bobby, what's happening over on technology?
Well, I wanted to pick up a post I wrote last week that was kind of spun off another eruption of the women in technology debate that came out of a TechCrunch UK event last week. The kind of point that I put forward on it was that there's no need to get defensive about it, but just look at the possibilities. You know, if more women are involved in technology, then, you know, it's a massive consumer industry in which the majority of people using it are women. You know, it seems crazy not to have more women in technology. But one of the comments which kind of drew in some of the threads we've been talking about today was from Maz PhD, who talked about it, but then said, as an aside, UK's Wired magazine has only one chief contributor who is female, and that's Baroness Greenfield, who's apparently our answer to women in the technology industry.
She's everywhere.
I see.
I think it's interesting, you know, someone the you know, who is a leading figure who's talking on this stuff is somebody who's kind of not really in technology at all, and seems to be fairly sceptical about the benefits of it. I think, you know, that that kind of role model issue is something that obviously needs to be addressed.
Well, I'd just like to jump in and say that when I was looking at the first issue of Wired when it came out in the UK, I saw a couple of female names, including Margaret Robertson, who is the former editor of Edge magazine, and she contributes. And Margaret is a, well, I can tell you because I know her, she's a lady, but Margaret's also a lady's name, even in this country, where you have Vivians and Leslies and Francis's and all that kind of stuff.
Yes, the last time I saw Margaret, she was definitely a woman.
She's a lady, yeah. That's for sure. Well, overall, speaking of games, over on the games blog, we had a massive reader survey to find out editorially how people, how our community wanted us to head. And on the games blog, we have a daily feature called the Chatterbox, which we implemented about... oh gosh, in 2006, and we specifically implemented it because we wanted people to stop going off topic on the very hard-nosed, you know, analytic posts that, that Keith, Greg, and I were writing. But one of the things that really annoys us about the Chatterbox is that on the front page of The Guardian Unlimited, the only post that ever comes up from the games blog is the daily Chatterbox because it's the most commented. And I said this, and Artie Fufkin, spelled with a one, he says, I have a great image in my head of you now, of you, Greg, and Keith, pulling a massive group strop as your insightful pieces of analysis are bumped from the front page in favor of another in-depth discussion of preferred zombie weapons. So I think that sums it up. Anyway, Charles, what's happening in technology?
There's been a story about a brothel on Twitter, advertising, it would seem, sort of suggesting discounts and things even, which is a story that originally those hardworking folk on the Sun seem to have found, which all of which drew Mitchell Adkow to give the following comment, which I think I'm going to read in a Colonel Bufton Tufton voice, just because it's sort of deserved.
Because we don't have Jemima here to do yes. her voice.
I have complained here before that The Guardian seems to be replacing journalists with Twitter as a source of news gathering. Now you seem to have moved on to reporting other papers' Twitter fines to save journalists even having to read tweets themselves. Looks like the 1st of April plan to move the paper fully onto Twitter wasn't actually such a far-fetched move at all.
And you can see pictures of that, that performance on our Flickr group. That was lovely. Well, you can get in on the conversations at guardian.co.uk/technology/blog/technology or /games blog.
In this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian, we find that the Oriental strategy board game Go has had professional players reigning supreme over computers. Until recently, when a new algorithm has begun to help machines beat the very best humans. We ask, why is Form attacking its critics? The ad-serving company seems to think it's the victim of smears, but its new UK-hosted website may backfire. It's a potential libel lawyer's jackpot. We count the cost of mobile broadband dongles, looking at the costs and problems of using them. And we look at e-voting, review Ubuntu 9.04, and ask, why does Africa lead the world in mobile banking? It's all in this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you very much for listening. And thanks also to our guests, Baroness Susan Greenfield and David Hamilton. Cheers to Pod People, Charles and Bobby, and to producer Scott over there in the glass box. Next week, we're speaking with the man who predicted the rise of the MP3. And I think, Charles, he actually invented the technology that led to, it's kind of a James Burke Connections kind of story, isn't it?
It is a bit like that, except that no one ever actually took it up, which is sort of sad tales for our time.
A bit like a Pete Best for our for the modern technology era. Anyway, we'll move on. Come back next week, next Tuesday, to listen to that story and for more pod goodness. Until then, I'm Alex Kratosky.